Mate.
I feel we almost mean like y'all ready for this. Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris, and I'm joined as always by my wonderful co-host Tom.
Hello.
And our good friend Eric is joining us again.
Hello, everyone.
And we all just finished watching Andrei Tarkovsky's 1972 sci-fi classic Solaris.
Yep.
Yeah, we did.
Who's confused? Raise your hands.
Yeah, a bit.
Yeah. It's an interesting one. I'd seen it twice before in my life. Once back in film school and once maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I kind of tried to tackle it again. I think it's a very interesting film, but yeah, neither of you guys had seen this before.
No.
That's right.
It was one I'd always wanted, well, for quite a while, wanted to read the book.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of wanted to see the film as well. Preferably in that order, but I haven't read the book, so much for that plan.
Mm. I suppose, should I do a plot synopsis quickly?
Yeah, you can try, yeah.
Go for it. That's why I'm throwing myself, under the bus here. So the film tells the story of a psychologist who is tasked with a mission to head to a space station orbiting a oceanic planet called Solaris. The space station has been orbiting for decades, kind of studying and trying to understand this planet. And it's kind of reaching the end of their mission, and this psychologist going up to assess the possible options of what could be done at this point, whether they abandon the mission and everything, or they continue their studying and things. And upon his arrival there, starts to experience a strange phenomena that it turns out is a reaction from the planet itself, kind of reacting to their human presence.
Bravo. That's pretty good.
That's a pretty good...
It's not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, it's in the form of kind of entities that are usually people who have... They're formed from their memories, so it's someone, you know, that has affected that person in their life. So, in the case of our psychologist, Dr. Chris Kelvin, we're presented the figure of his dead wife.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's really the only one you sort of see. You see a couple of flashes of and hear about other people's manifestations. See a little small man.
There's a little man, little person, who is the manifestation of
Dr. Krieger.
Yeah.
Sartorius.
Sartorius.
Yeah. He's a very Kriegerish man.
Yeah, he's identical to Dr. Krieger from Archer.
Yes, he very briefly has a little reveal of a male little person, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps it's sort of hinted at that one of the other guys on the station, Snout, has perhaps a baby manifesting, but you never actually really see more than an ear at one stage.
Yeah, and then there's a little fleeting glimpse of Jabaria, or the doctor...
Garbarian?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
You get a brief glimpse of the small child, like a little girl.
Yeah, and sorry, there is that other woman walking around the station. Yeah. That actually could be Snout, so it wasn't overly clear.
It probably was, actually.
The film never...
It
doesn't focus on those things.
Yeah, the film is very solidly focusing on Chris's narrative and
yeah,
trying to explore...
Thanks for helping, Tom.
Tom's just sitting back with a beer, just like, hey, have at it, boys.
Yeah, he's doing a great job.
Can you pass the wine?
Mm.
On that note.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so, well summarised, and including the problems, I guess, that arise.
Yeah.
Where do you start? Do we just start from the start of the film? And just sort of...
Let's go a little bit slow, because I think if we try and tackle...
To take on.
Yeah, like all of the stuff that's going on within the film, we're going to trip ourselves up. Let's warm up. by talking about the film outside of the themes. Maybe, like, mm-hmm. let's talk about pacing, let's talk about...
Okay, that's a good idea.
Yep. So we'll do it in sort of the two halves? Or
well, I guess, like, a good way to approach it, like, based on kind of what Tom was just saying, it's... As people that had never seen this before, what was your takeaway? Like, did you enjoy it?
It was thought-provoking, but...
Not what you expected, I'm guessing.
I've just seen sci-fi films that I thought more clearly provoked thought, is how yeah. I'd put it. It definitely had interesting style. I mean, it was 1972, so, you know, when was 2001? That was 1970, wasn't
69.
It? 69, yeah. So it was groundbreaking.
68, maybe. Sorry.
No, that's all right. So it was clearly groundbreaking at the time in terms of sci-fi stuff. This, that they tried hard with their sets. Some of them were pretty, like, they had a freaking stateroom on their space station.
Mm. Yeah.
A chandelier.
Yeah.
It was pretty Russian, really.
Yeah, there's a lot of, yeah, that was one thing that was strange to me. It was like, you've spent so much money trying to get all those kilograms of stuff up into orbit. It's like, yeah, how did you afford that energy?
Yeah.
But anyway.
So there were some question marks over the that side of things. But yes, as the film, you've got to get, you know, you've got to already... I look at it, it's like, okay, no, it actually was a 1972 sci-fi. And it's pretty epic, really, in terms of what they were trying to take on in terms of length and theme. I can't...
Yeah, it's one, like, those sort of design elements and things, I think, take a back seat, because most of Tarkovsky's films are just, like, pure thematical experiments.
Yeah, and there weren't many...
Or not experiments, like, expeditions is probably a better word.
And there weren't many settings. Like, there was, like, a corridor. There were a couple of different corridors they used. They used the one with all the microwave oven drawer things. And then there was the one with the circular windows. And then there was the library, which was the stateroom kind of thing. And then there was his bedroom. So really on the space station, only like four spots that they kind of just kept reusing.
Mm.
So yeah, they didn't try and go, hey, check out this new cool part of the space station. Or you never even saw the space vehicle that Chris was even in. You just saw a close-up on his face as he came into land and stuff. And then the space station from a distance. So they didn't put emphasis on, like, Space Odyssey obviously has the awesome ship.
That's like that the pure spectacle.
Yeah,
and the
it has spectacle.
It.
And that's what it... part of what it tries
that's
to
almost,
do.
That film's almost like the antithesis of this, because it's trying to show you how awesome it is to explore outwardly into space.
Mm.
And then this one is just like, no, we need to go inside.
Come back from space.
We're talking about minds here, not out there.
Well, that's the interesting... that's an interesting point. Like, what is the... why then... if it's an inward exploration of all of these interesting themes, what is the need to set it within a science fiction narrative?
It's almost like a reaction to the need to explore.
Yeah.
It's like, why is everyone going out into the cosmos when really we need to go inside us and figure out who we are?
Yeah.
So, like, to me, it's perfect. You go out into space to talk about what's inside of you.
Yeah,
it's like, cool. It kind of works in that way.
Mm.
And then the catalyst is obviously like an alien thing that's manifesting and making you, like, forcing you to look inside yourself. So
yeah.
Yep.
And I don't know when the book was written. I don't know if that probably matters a little bit, but...
I think like 61.
Okay, so the book was written, and then the film was obviously 72, so 3 years after the moon landing. Like, it was just like space race central when the film came out. So, yes, I guess it was in the golden age of space exploration. And even if the book was written in 61, that was first flight, I think, in space. Yuri Gagarin, Russian guy. Cool. Yep.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Let's lock that in. 61, yeah.
Anyway, feel free to call me out on that. It was roughly that time, I think, if not that year. So that's when spaceflight really, for humans in space, I think that's when they achieved it. So before that, there was a bit of Sputnik and rockets and all that sort of stuff. So even when the book was written, that was already becoming a reality. So yeah, that would match a peak of exploration for humans into space. So yeah, set it in space and go, actually.
Yeah.
And Snout has that speech in there where he talks about how...
everyone should, rather than going out to the cosmos, we need to hold a mirror up to ourselves, is his words.
Yeah, man is man.
Man is man.
Yeah. So, Yes, you could have. I'm sure there are plenty of films do address that stuff on Earth. So it was a different setting for
no,
it.
No,
so
no. Yeah.
And yeah, the alien entity, I mean, at the end of the day, whilst it's quite central, it's not a huge focus of the film. It's just, it's there to drive things.
It's there to provoke and draw out the,
everything else.
Yeah, the, yeah. Like, causing Chris to explore all of these things, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, well, all of the humans on the space station seem to be struggling to communicate with the thing.
It's not, it's not like communication in the sense of understanding how and why and what it is, or communication just in the everyday sense, you mean?
Well, if you think about it, like if it's a really abstract alien, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't really have a form until you create a form for it, and then obviously, you know, it's a pretty abstract entity.
It is.
And like, so if you wanted to try... I mean, it's obviously trying to communicate with you because it's getting into your mind and sharing your experiences and trying its best to...
To live through those...
Yeah, well, I was always trying to figure out, like, why is it making a creation from your experience? Is it trying to say, well, if I take a memory and I manifest this memory, then that's my link to start communicating with these things.
Yeah, and to be like, I want to be a part of you or connected to some degree.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, I actually was wondering if it was a defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Because it only happened after they bombarded it, I guess, with radiation waves, X-rays, and then these visions started appearing. And the only effect of the visions really was to drive all of the crew crazy, more or less.
That's true.
Except for the couple who managed to stay, wanted to stay around, and the ones who didn't kill themselves.
Yeah, but are they going crazy because they're being presented with their pasts? And if you can't escape your past, is it...
Yeah,
like for a lot of these people, they're going crazy because there's something about their past that they don't want to face, or...
I think there's a few things, because, there's a bit of... Yeah, also reality. You're seeing this... visions that you know aren't truly real.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
They? And there's all in the film obviously discusses quite a bit about you know, Earth being home, and there's a lot of images of Earth and nature and things like that, and then contradicted with a different planet or an artificial environment. So I think there's a lot of reasons for people to go crazy in that kind of situation.
Mm.
We were told early-ish, so let's say halfway through the film, about an hour and 20 minutes in, that Chris's manifestation, his past, his dead wife, she keeps coming back. So they're like, oh, she's immortal like some of the other ones. So others, obviously, they had been killing off their manifestations, their guests, along the way, and then a different guest would appear. And then, yeah, like, because Snout was talking about, oh, you put her in the rocket and blew her out, so other people just, like, stab theirs.
Yeah, you went big right off the bat, yeah.
Yeah, jeez.
It's
funny because it's so slow.
Yeah.
And from moment to moment, I felt like there was not a lot going on.
Mm.
But then when you look back after you've watched it, and start retroactively unpacking everything. There's just so much there.
Yeah.
But scene to scene...
It's methodic.
Yeah.
It's very slowly paced for a reason, and it's just slow... It's contemplative, I think, is a good word for...
Yeah, well, but at the same time, there was many sequences where I was confused and didn't know what was happening until later... I was given the information to go, oh, okay, I get it now.
Mm.
But then, wouldn't it be better for me to know the information so as it's happening,
that's definitely
I can think
easier,
about
right?
What's happening and themes that are going on, all that sort of stuff, rather than just being like, I hope that they tell me what's happening eventually. That didn't happen all the time, but it did happen from time to time.
Yeah. Things weren't obvious at times. Like,
we should give examples. Like that.
Even when his wife first showed up, it wasn't that clear because it had lingered on an image we discussed at the time, a picture, but I think that was actually a picture of his dead mother.
I think you're right.
So it actually never revealed it was his wife until a little bit. He seemed very familiar with her, and then eventually.
Well, they kissed. Kind
of,
Like, she rocks up out of nowhere, and then...
just kisses him
on his sleep. They kiss, and you're just like, oh, who is this person?
What is going on?
Then yeah. I think one of you mentioned that there was a framed picture earlier that you might have seen that was her, but then you still don't really know who it is, though. It's a person that...
No, I think now, after seeing the whole film a few more times, like, oh, I'm pretty sure that was the mum, actually, the blonde, who also... I lost it a little bit in the film, whether she disappeared or he left home when he was young or something.
He left.
Yeah. Yeah. He said something about running out on her or something like that.
Yeah. So it's a confusing problem to go and sit and watch the movie. On rewatch, it'd be a whole different story.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I do like the idea that you sit there watching it and you're confused and kind of going crazy. It's like,
it's reflective of characters themselves.
Well, yeah. And it's, you know, when what's his name? Snout?
Yeah.
When he mentions, like, you know, we should be holding up a mirror. When we were watching there's this really long sequence of the winter painting.
Yes.
The township or whatever it is. And it was, I couldn't work out what it was trying to say. I couldn't figure out the metaphors. I couldn't figure out anything. And then I was trying to think about, like, well, then if it doesn't mean anything, why is it here? And I started to think that maybe the film is so slowly paced and making you... it's almost getting bored. You get bored through it. And so eventually you just start looking at yourself and go, like, why am I bored by this? And all that sort of stuff. And so the movie itself becomes a kind of mirror. And so I think that's why it's so slowly paced. Because it's trying to make you look at yourself, go, like, why am I reacting to this film in this way and all that sort of stuff?
That's interesting.
Well, that, yeah. Okay.
That's
so it's working on almost a meta level.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you can get bored. You get bored by it. I'm sure certain people will get bored.
Oh, a lot of people wouldn't make it through the first third.
Yeah.
Like, that is a slow beginning.
But as soon as I kind of thought that maybe that's what the film's going to do, the slow moments of the film, I was kind of enjoying them a bit more.
You get an opportunity to just kind of soak them in and actually try and be like, well, what?
Yeah, it was what? Like a...
everything
like
is here for a reason. What is this reason for doing this?
Yeah, it was like a meditation almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, once they got into space, I was more interested. I thought the film... not just for the space thing, but just the pacing seemed to change quite significantly.
Or was it 43 minutes in?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the Earth stuff was important because a lot of the themes of the film were about life, the images of the water and the creek and things like that.
It's setting up the natural world at the beginning. Yeah, and like the fact that he relishes it. He goes for a walk for an hour every morning. And it also establishes him as a very pragmatic character in his dismissal of Burton and all of those stories.
It doesn't dwell on his character enough, though. That was my problem. At the start, they take ages to just do not a lot. And considering the second two-thirds of the film are like a study into Chris, really.
A deep dive on his psyche.
A massive dive on his psyche, but they never set him up that well, I don't think. You had brief bits where he spoke to the ex-pilot from like 20 years ago.
Well, I thought the movie was going to be about that guy, but I think
he thought it was about Burton.
Yeah. But you heard Burton's story, which is interesting because it gave you backstory onto when weird stuff started happening on Solaris and like people started seeing apparitions, perhaps.
But it established by that point, that Chris was kind of skeptical.
Chris hadn't even spoken in the film, I don't think, at that stage.
Yeah.
Afterwards, you knew he was very skeptical about science, and that was all you really got out of it. He liked nature. And he was pretty skeptical about the whole science-y thing.
Mm.
And for some reason, he was going up to the space station. But you never really got truly told much about why, except it was about whether or not they should just stop researching or not. Should they or shouldn't they keep looking into this? Because they weren't really getting anywhere.
Yeah.
But you never got enough Chris, so that once you got to space, and literally in the space of like 4 hours, he was crazy.
Yeah. That's sort of
just,
one of my...
all of a sudden just... flips, and you didn't know enough about his character beforehand to make the second two-thirds of his change transition, or descent or transition.
It's that thing, if you hope once he gets to the space station, you're going to actually spend some time with him to get to know him as he clinically goes through and does his job.
What is his job?
To assess and analyse the situation, I guess?
I thought it was like, if he's a psychologist or something, he's going to evaluate the other...
Yeah, and I think by doing that, we could get a better sense of who he is as a person. But no, it's like literally within 30 minutes of him arriving, he starts seeing visions and goes insane.
Yeah, like straight away.
Or like, you know, quoting.
He meets them both really quickly, and then he falls asleep, dreams, and his ex-wife materializes. So he puts her in a rocket and blasts her out into space, and sets himself on fire. And from that point on, it's all of that study.
The gloves are off,
and we still haven't met. We never met Chris properly in the first place.
Yeah,
to make his boss or whatever.
Well, is that an interesting thing of what the film is doing then? In that we meet Chris through his memories, since the film itself is an exploration on the importance and the impact of memory. Is that why Tarkovsky purposely withholds any of that, and we know him through that?
I guess you emerge knowing that he deeply cared for Hari, his wife.
And that only comes out through the memory.
Through the memory and through him. It was actually pretty good timing for me, because I just finished rewatching the TV show Westworld, not the movie, but
the TV show. Yeah.
And that's all about what is human and things like that.
Mm.
And so some of this was really just like, I swear I just watched this the other day. But with less blood. Mm. But no spoilers for that show. But there was just sort of similar stuff looking into what makes you human and memory and that sort of stuff as well.
Well, the manifestation of Hari.
And her
trying to figure out whether she can be human even though she's a copy herself. Mm.
Well, at this point, do we deep dive into the themes now then? I guess
we kind of worked our way there fairly well.
Let's go for it.
So, like, essentially that's what the film is. It's an exploration and a study into what is human, like what is humanity, I guess, and in particular focusing on memories and love, I guess, are the two kind of...
and questioning where science sits in all of that at the same time. And what's real and what's not.
With some existentialism thrown in there.
It's got a few themes. plus it's in space. All right, so where's the best one to start with?
I mean, I guess...
We could break down each character.
Yeah?
Because they're all representative of something.
I think that's a good idea. Well, we could probably do the Sartorius.
Yeah.
Because he's got probably the smallest role of the main characters, in a way.
Very hardline scientist.
Your classic
The duty
clinical...
of the scientist is to just fucking get to the bottom of the facts and...
Yep.
Don't you worry about that love nonsense and all that
shit. She's not real.
Very pragmatic.
Yeah, it's just science. That's what I'm here for. That's my job. This stuff's weird, but get over it. Let's figure this out.
But then the others are saying that he's not acting like... Where's his humanity then, right?
And that's it. He seems... And as a viewer, he's not really kind to anybody. And you go, where is his humanity? Like, he doesn't really get along with anyone.
Yeah.
Whereas Snout, being the next character, I guess, I'd describe him as jaded. He goes on his big speech about why, you know, look, man is man, and looking back, hold up that mirror to ourselves, and we're reaching further out into the galaxy just to find things when we need to almost find ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But he also he just sort of seems a bit jaded about humans in general. Unfortunately, I don't remember a good quote from him to back that one up.
Do you think his jaded nature comes from his experiences on the space station and the years he spent there in experiencing this kind of self-exploration has caused him to become jaded and have a cynical look towards humanity because he himself has spent years doing this exploration that he feels all of mankind needs to do, I guess, to some
degree. Interesting question, because there is a bit of a chat between him and Chris towards the end where Chris asks him his age and how long he's been out there, revealing that, yes, he has been out there for a very, very long time and kind of implying, well, why the hell are you still here? You don't really tend to enjoy it that much.
Yeah.
And you wonder if maybe he never liked Earth that much to begin with.
Yeah.
So this is a chance to find out another entity or another consciousness or something. He's sort of in between. He's quite friendly and receptive.
Mm.
Yeah, but
also...
I couldn't put my finger down on him, to be honest.
No, he was a bit of a question mark because he got, you know, he still got pretty super drunk at his depressing birthday.
Yeah.
and he made everyone read Don Quixote or whatever it was.
Which is, that's an interesting, well, that thing, you know, has stuff to do with visions and stuff, so.
Yes. Yeah,
good, it's good kind of a nice parallel.
And then...
But then Hari is like, she's always saying, she says it in that same scene where he's talking, doing that little speech. Oh, fuck. What'd she say?
She says how she's becoming more human every day, I think, in that time, doesn't she?
Like, yeah.
She can feel.
Yeah. And then, but then she also says that, you know, you're all kind of fucked up. You're all different. But you're all human as well. Like, it's all part of every single one. You're a scientist and you don't love anybody.
Yep.
But you're human. That's a very human.
Yeah.
You have human qualities.
Yep.
And this guy over here is like not a scientist at all, but he loves, you know.
Yeah, there's no.
He's willing to love.
What defines us as. What is the clinical definition of human?
Yep. Yeah. And then she goes on to say, yeah, you know, I love this man. I'm not Hari, but I am Hari, sort of.
Yeah.
Is what she sort of says.
I'm technically not human, but I am human.
I feel everything because of the way I've been manifested. I feel, feel and experience everything. But
And since I experience all of those emotions and feelings, does that make me any less human than you?
Mm, and she's probably the most emotional character in the whole film.
Yeah. There's like not a single scene where she isn't crying.
She's crying all the time.
The actress does a phenomenal job in that.
I mean, she even tries to. Yeah, I agree. She even commits suicide, but it doesn't work because she's invincible.
Yeah. I think. Got nothing.
Yeah. And then finally, Chris, I don't know, it's a bit hard because. And maybe it was a conscious decision, but yes, you don't know him early on, but you know that he is quite calculated and probably non-scientific. But as it's revealed throughout the film, he obviously, despite his failed marriage, maybe, or something, whatever previously happened, he's obviously really empathetic and knows how to love and wants to love. So he's got the most sort of emotional involvement out of any of them.
Well, he considers Hari to be...
the closest... is pretty much
human,
yeah,
right. Mm. Even though, because I think he says after she heals herself from drinking liquid oxygen, that you know, you were never Hari. Oh fuck, it's like a confusing situation.
Yeah,
he's explaining that you're not Hari,
but to me you are.
But now you're the new version of Hari.
Yes,
you know what I mean. So, yeah. So he's very willing to accept. That perhaps the essence of a human is not the body, but
the mind and the
feelings. The mind, and if the mind's carried through his experience, like her mind is carried through his experience and manifested through his experience into another version of her, then what's the difference?
The interesting one, I guess, with that is actually, now that I think about it, is earlier in the film they do talk about how the guests, so to speak, are people's memories of that person.
Yeah, they're not that person.
They're not, no. So specifically.
So they're only an image of the person.
Yeah, they're an image,
so they're not
They're that person's memory. So if your memory was quite hazy of that person...
Plus everyone has secrets.
Yes, yes.
So you can never truly be...
that individual.
Yeah.
But does that stop them being...
It's a copy that's lost a lot of information.
Well, the Krieger doctor's name.
Sartorius.
He says, you're a copy, you're a facsimile, you're a matrix of that person. You are not that. So.
But I'm saying that they're not even a direct copy. Like
No.
But that's not to say that they're not human as well.
No. Yes, which is what the film is.
They're their own version, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I think, the film uses, it's very purposefully why we focus in on Hari and Chris's... their connection, this new manifestation of Hari, because it's using the idea of love as the core emotion of the exploration of what can be human.
So are we saying connection?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's focusing in on her as the... like, that's kind of why we don't see any of the other guests or really focus on any of the other characters' dealings with theirs, is because... Tarkovsky is using that as like the linchpin, the idea of like the dissection of what makes us human, emotion and love and connection.
But what about our capacity to connect with things that aren't human? Because if you're bombarding an ocean that is, I'm going to say, sentient, with poison,
yes,
and then it's trying to communicate with you in an abstract way, and you can't figure out a way to communicate, or you won't figure out a way to communicate, as is the case with some of the people on board. Then there's this whole other thing going on as well about, not just about what humans are, it's also about how humans interact with everything else.
Yes.
So,
well, yep. on that note, it's an interesting thing of, that apparently is more what the original source material was based on.
Okay.
It was the idea of what constitutes a life form and your interaction with that, and what can you assess as life. And that's the exploration of the novel.
A sentient ocean.
Yeah, is that life? And the fact that it can manifest itself in these ways, does that constitute consciousness and life?
Yeah.
And that's where the original novel apparently explores, but Tarkovsky deviated into the
human exploration. Yeah. Yep.
I love the whole... I'm going to have to read the book, because I love the whole idea of how, the struggle to communicate with everything but humans.
Yes.
It's the heart. It's kind of easy. You can relate to humans, so it's easier to communicate relatively easily.
But yes, to a...
Everything else
to
is...
To a viscous... ocean.
Or even a dog, it doesn't really matter, whatever. That's such a fucking interesting thing to
probably think about. The closest example or similar thing I can think of is the book and the movie Arrival. Similar, just communication as a tool that obviously explores in different things, but that sort of was something I was thinking of a little bit throughout. Communication, what makes communication, or how do you get past that sort of stuff? But you didn't focus on that too heavily.
No.
And I think you would have been trying to do too many things.
And it's also, it is Tarkovsky taking a simple idea, I think, of this novel. And, that idea and then branching and making it his own. Because everything he does deals with these kind of deep, dealings with what it is to be human. And, dealing with an existential crisis of humanity.
And what did the author think of the deviation from his original plot?
I'll save that for trivia. Unless you want to hear it now, I'll
We're talking about it. It's probably pretty relative.
Stanislaw Lem, the author, he had was scathing, apparently, of the adaptation of his novel. Which is interesting, because he helped co-write the screenplay. But then I think...
Is he credited for it as well?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. But then I think it is obviously, he wasn't involved on set and stuff.
No. It's such a tonal piece as well.
He apparently complained that he did not write it about people's, quote, erotic problems in space.
Wow.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so he got totally misrepresented in his opinion.
Yep. That was not what he was going for. Which is, like I said, Tarkovsky has taken this idea and kind of branched it off, like the simple base idea of, a space station and this setting and scenario, and used it to explore the similar themes that he constantly likes to explore with his art.
Yeah, and so, I mean...
Which is fine.
That happens in sci-fi all the time. Yeah. I mean, the story for Total Recall is like 6 pages long.
Yeah. And Verhoeven made it awesome.
Yeah, it certainly did.
What part of this movie was erotic?
I think the author just didn't get the film at all. He watched it and thought, what is this trash?
He views love as erotic.
Yeah.
Human connection is saucy.
He watched this dude sexing up this fake lady.
Yeah.
Even though there's none of that actually in the film.
Yeah.
Sounds like a real sci-fi writer.
It sounds like he got bored halfway through. Well, not even halfway.
Oh, God.
So do we want to talk a little bit about, what we were almost going to earlier on, and talk about the artistic side of it, colors and
the paint. I think this, most of Tarkovsky's stuff, is absolutely gorgeously shot. In particular, I mean, that the opening scene on Earth with Chris kind of going on his walk across his property and stuff, it is amazing visuals. It's just very simple shots, but the composition and the color palettes he uses. And throughout the film as well, the constant shifting of colour and the way he frames his shots are so striking, I think, that even though the film can be slow, it kind of never necessarily loses you 100%.
Because, at least there's something to look at.
Yeah, it's very visually interesting.
I feel he got some of his pacing a little wrong at times.
Yeah.
Just in that first part. They just could have tightened it slightly, but I think the emphasis was to show Earth.
Yeah, and I think it's so the...
I know why it's there,
the
I think,
issue with but... the slow pacing early on as well is you don't know what the movie is or where we're going or what's happening. So that's...
No.
That makes it even more excruciating.
Yeah.
There's a sequence, I think like half an hour into it, where Burton is driving down streets...
Yeah,
for ages.
Yes,
back into the city for about 5 minutes at least. I'm just in the car and then watching him. To me, that I mean, yes, it was long and
it looks great, right? But it's like, what's like, going on
feels
here?
Like a
what
little are you trying art to say? Essay in the middle of the film?
Yes.
For me, because the city got busier and busier, and it got darker and darker, and you got lights and stuff. For me, that was showing a shift from the countryside to the city, and showing a different like setting and side of humanity. You know, you got this. Little country property on its own. You've got the lakes and the rivers and those shots of like the rippling stream, and then you've got the busy city and you've got humanity in a larger society kind of point of view. So to me, that was just trying to, in particular, the stuff that popped up later. Earth. Don't know if you needed 5 minutes of it.
Yeah.
Well, maybe. Yeah. I said before that it's trying to get you to think about how you're reacting to it.
Yeah.
So, I'm just going to... Every time it's just like, why is this so long? I'm just going to go back to that.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's
a good approach.
Yeah. And I think that's... For me, the art piece was similar in a way. That was just another look back at humanity. And even the set designs, this kind of stupid library stateroom kind of thing, at the end of the day, it had a lot of very... Earth things in there. It was a fake statue of the Venus de Milo, unless they had the real one and made her bigger. They had some old pistols. They had a chandelier in there. They had a trumpet on the wall. They had all these like icons of humanity. They all had items in space that were just stupid. There was just like a rug hanging off the top of a shelf, but they were all very human, earthy items. And that I think was to sort of either just random set design that was odd, but to me it was more they were a bit purposeful at least, trying to like create a very...
Well, it's the library, right?
Yeah, the library all... in particular, whereas other areas were more science-y, I guess.
It was almost like a temple.
Temple, yeah.
Because they're all kind of... I think there's a bunch of sequences where they're talking about the pursuit of knowledge is, you know, paramount, and, you know, that's the number one goal. So if that's the case, then the library is your temple... And so you adorn it with all the lovely cultural stuff. And then everything else is really flat.
Sterile and clinical.
Yeah. That's true. So the library did have all the items that had the most...
earthy feel.
Earthy humanity kind of setting to them outside of the scientific environment. But, yes, so that was that. And then, the colours, the sepia tones and the black and whites and stuff. Go, Chris.
It's
with the sepia seem to match up with dreams and questionable reality.
Yes, that's what I.
And then everything real was in color, more or less.
More or less, yeah.
And what about the blue tone? We weren't in Washington.
The blue tone. Yeah, we kept likening this back to Soderbergh's Traffic,
which I think was the last podcast I did. So.
Yeah, still works. No, the very grey tone, the bluey tones, like are you thinking like with Burton's discussing of his...
Yeah, there was that. So that was sort of a flashback
style. And then also him in the car and things like that as well.
Yeah, a few Burton ones.
That's all through screens. That's them either watching video or having video chats and stuff. It's all presented through blue kind of grey toned thing as a presentation of this is
a screened image.
A screen or a filmed image being presented within this world to kind of help separate.
Yeah. Was Chris ever in blue tone? I thought he might have been at one stage, but I don't
know. No, he's definitely in sepia and in black and white, but he never goes
blue. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
The sepia tone is more dreamy, black and white. I don't remember what that was.
So sepia tones were dreams. Oh, that cut. Yeah, that
questionable reality.
Questionable reality. Black and white was flat out memory.
Okay.
Because
his mum at the end.
Yep.
Yep.
Because there's only I think maybe one or two instances of just straight black and white, and that you're led to believe that is just a straight memory. Him having a memory as opposed to a dream or an altered reality state.
Yep. Because his early encounter with Harry was in sepia tones.
Yes.
In a dream.
Yes.
And then
And then that once is she comes what back again, out of the...
Yeah, once he's awake, it's in colour.
Yep.
Then he jettisons her in a rocket. Yeah, goes to sleep again, has another sepia dream.
She's manifesting herself in those dreams and then being pulled out from them into the reality.
Yep. Okay. And then the rest of the film more or less in colour.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, she's real.
It's an interesting approach to be able to help the audience to some degree kind of separate, but it is still super confusing.
Yeah, because it wasn't as obvious as some of those, some colour-shifting films. Like
yeah.
Traffic was the one that, like I said, it's easy. If we're in Mexico, it's yellow.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much.
But this one, yeah, it wasn't as obvious until perhaps halfway through.
Well, when you say it like you just have said, it seems pretty clear. But then while you're watching it,
it wasn't as obvious.
Fucking Jesus.
Because you just all of a sudden are, we're in sepia now, what the fuck's going on? Like
it seems to shift a lot at the start.
Yes.
And then it doesn't need to at the end because it set those rules and then we've found what reality is. But yeah, exactly. At the start, it's like a swapping. What, I know this is thematic, but I can't quite place this.
Mm.
I think
I'd like to talk about the ending.
The very, very ending. Yeah, I think that's a good spot to kind of roll to.
We wanted to talk about anything else before we tackle the ending.
I think for me, it's probably everything I have to talk about. We've hit most things
We're doing all right.
Yeah.
I'm happy to hit the ending.
Let's give the ending a crack.
Yeah.
Because it's...
It's an interesting...
Yeah.
Ambiguous.
Yeah?
Well, let's talk about whether it's ambiguous then.
Yeah, Chris, what do you reckon? You had the most optimistic yeah.
In that, It's the pull-out shot of the island on Solaris, and it is the... it is ambiguous in the sense of you don't fully... You're not told 100% whether or not he has decided to fully stay or if it is his return or what is going on, but it's pretty... I'd give it probably an 80-20.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean... Because we know that Solaris has been building islands over the last week or whatever.
Also islands specifically based off of his brain pattern as well.
So whatever's down there has built these islands...
Based off of his consciousness.
Right. Almost like it's trying to coax him down. Yeah. I'll build you a home precisely how you want it.
You don't have to leave. You can, yeah.
Here's a little island for you to live on. Yes, that's probably true.
Yeah.
But we're not going to give you your dead wife. We're going to give you a weird construct of your father.
And a leaky, leaky house.
And a leaky house.
Yeah. Or is he...
Or is it leaky because it's risen out of the water?
That was my other thought.
Yeah.
Yep.
But at the same time, has he gone back...
Without a group of reality.
But he's got a mixed sense of reality now.
Yeah, that's
what I was wondering. Whether he'd gone back to Earth, but just couldn't get his experiences out of his mind.
Because the whole point of going out there was to figure out whether people have lost their sense of reality.
Mm.
And, you know, they're thinking hallucinations, as far as people on Earth say.
Yeah.
Hallucinations are not real, but... To these people, it's very real.
Yeah.
But then they're doubting themselves all the time. It could be taken both ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, and particularly...
I think
metaphorically
the latter metaphorical is kind of more in line with the film as a whole, I think. It's... Yeah.
Yeah. And particularly, once again, I guess if it is... There's either adaptive for the planet. It's like, yeah, we'll coax you down here. Or it suits the defense mechanism one as well. You hit me with more radiation waves, I'm just going to mess you all up.
Ben, we're just talking about an ending in terms of what actually could have happened, but
mm.
I think the more interesting question is, what do each of these endings mean?
Mm.
Really? Because if Chris has decided to go back to the planet and live there, he's living in his past experience.
Which is a fake constructed...
Yeah, well, there's no sense of a future then.
Yeah, and it wasn't money.
Well,
anyway.
There might be, because you're kind of communicating with another life form, and maybe that's what he's going for.
Or is he just retreated
into his past completely?
Yeah, does he not want to leave the memory of his wife, even though she's not actively there? Does he not want to leave her? He found sort of some degree of happiness or purpose, perhaps, up there that he wasn't going to have.
What was the point of the thing of kept waiting and she never came back? Never mind. There was like one character talking about one of their guests, I think. Yeah. Or like a specific memory and wanting to inhabit that, and it's just, you can just keep waiting and waiting and in the vain hope that it is going to happen, but it may not.
Maybe he's, chosen to wait for Hari there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And got his father instead.
Which kind of leans further into the idea of the love. Like, he's doing this and giving up everything that he had
for love.
For the love aspect. But
yeah.
Which is why he falls to his knees, is because he didn't get specifically what he wanted, I guess.
Or maybe his deepest love is his father, who knows?
Yeah. And his dog.
Yeah, and his dog. He actually got two constructs. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
He just needs to go to bed.
He needs to
have a nap and hope that his wife shows up.
Yeah.
Oh, shit, but
I'm trying to poison his father and hope he comes back is the wife. I'm not sure.
I'm trying to get a takeaway from the film, but it's such grand, lofty, philosophical stuff that I don't even think the smartest minds in existence have ever
pinned it down. I don't know if Tarkovsky intended it to have a clear...
I doubt it, based on what you've told me about the guy.
If you're questioning what's human...
There is no definitive answer.
Essentially, no one will ever know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what he's put in the film, as we said, with all the different characters and Hari herself saying, you're human, but you're different from him, who's also human, etc.
So. It's just an exploration.
Yeah.
I like that they're going for the whole love angle, though. That was. I believe in that, too.
Yeah. So
that's nice. I can get behind that.
I like love.
I'm supportive of it.
But, unless you guys have got anything else and you think we've kind of tackled it all right.
I think we've, done pretty
good. I've done the best I could.
I think we did all right. I think we did okay. This is one I was very worried about, and I think we've pulled it out.
Okay.
Yep.
Good. So on that note, we'll move on to trivia.
Let's do it.
So the film was nominated for the Palme d'Or at the 1972 Cannes Film Festival. It didn't win that, but it did end up winning a grand prize of the special grand prize of the jury, as well as the Fipreski Prize at that year's festival.
Mm-hmm.
This was the most widely seen of Andrei Tarkovsky's films outside of the Soviet Union. However, Tarkovsky himself reportedly considers this the least favorite of his own films.
Really?
Hmm.
Interesting.
I think that is the best I could kind of decipher from that is because he attempted to do science fiction in an attempt to do a more populist kind of style of filmmaking.
He wanted to make his film mainstream?
Not necessarily mainstream, but attempt a more accessible genre while still containing his type of thing.
His artistic style.
Yeah, and I think it's ends up not being... It is very clearly a Tarkovsky film, but it's not compared to some of the other stuff he does.
No.
Like, I think Stalker is more of him doing a sci-fi film. There's very little, like... There's a bit of a... Like, you know, the setting and the idea is science fiction, but it's not a sci-fi film, really. Like, it's... That's him doing that, I think, really successfully.
Mm-hmm.
Did
you like it more than Andrei Rublev?
Which one? This?
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. No, I think Andrei Rublev is the problem of it is just 5 hours of bombarding you with themes while a guy aimlessly walks around the countryside. It's fucking rough. I know we copped so much shit from our listeners for not liking that film, but I stand by it. Tarkovsky's a filmmaker that I find all of his films visually interesting, but in terms of whether or not I can engage with them as a viewer, it's 50-50.
Like, yeah, this one was a good example. His themes are really interesting, and his shots are really lovely, but
it's the pacing, it is
tough to watch. There's like zero exposition, and you don't really need that. You know, you can have that in some films and not at all, but it is difficult at times to just, you kind of, I found myself looking at the clock a lot of times, and I do like my themes and my sci-fi. Anyway, sorry.
I think we should return to Andrei Rublev.
Yeah, we were talking about this while watching Solaris, whether or not we do a special thing for like an anniversary or something where we go back and we kind of reassess maybe one or two films from we've done previously. Because
that was like 20 episodes in.
And we're now, what, 160-odd in?
Yeah.
Like, we've gotten better at this.
Yeah, I'm sure we've improved over the course of the podcast trying to unpack this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not ready for it now.
No, I really don't want to sit down and rewatch a flat.
But one day I do want to go back and look at it, having watched a whole bunch of other artistic films.
With a better understanding of what this artist was trying to do.
Yes,
and approaching.
Exactly.
Yeah. While Solaris mostly concerns itself with real-world technology and doesn't refer to it much, it does correctly predict two devices, which did in fact become commonplace. Home video recording and widescreen flat-panel TVs are featured in the film.
Oh, yeah.
About 20 years before they became a thing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. Ironically, they are both shown in the pastoral first part of the film and not in a futuristic setting of the space station. In Chris Cullen's room, you can see a painting of Andrei Rublev.
Oh, right.
One of the classic, like, iconoclast self-portraits of Rublev is on his wall. This is obviously Tarkovsky kind of referencing that.
Obviously.
Yeah. A print was screened at Cinema Village Theatre in New York City in the mid-1980s that combined an English dub version of the film with sequences of a Russian language print. This version also featured cheesy 1970s era titles. God, I wish I could find them somehow.
Sounds great.
Around this time, this was considered the most complete version of the film available in the United States. It was not until the reopening of the New York Forum Theater in 1989 that a complete and uncut Russian language version was shown there theatrically. A number of sources claim that the Soviet officials withheld the 165-minute version from export. Moss Films did indeed issue versions for export, and subtitled prints were actually shown in the United States in 1973. They were just kind of lost to the wayside, like, you know, out into the ether of the world. Because,
wasn't much demand for it.
I guess. Not when Star Wars comes out, like, 2 years later.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of sci-fi world at that point.
Yep.
It's quite common to hear the film compared to 2001: A Space Odyssey. However, I think that's in terms of, like, to some degree, pacing and, like, you know, the exploration of themes, and I think visual styling somewhat.
Yeah.
Like, the production. It's nowhere near as grand as, like, we've already mentioned.
It's grand.
It is grand.
Solaris is really grand.
I know.
It's just a different kind of grand.
That's what I mean. It's not as operatic, I'll say,
yeah,
as 2001. Yeah.
Okay.
Well spoken.
However, Tarkovsky had not actually seen the film before shooting Solaris. He did finally get around to seeing 2001 afterwards, and he criticized it for being sterile.
Oh, man. Fuck.
Yeah.
I guess you could, anyway.
Yeah, and the final bit, the extended scene where Burton is... the extended scene following Burton as he rides around the city was filmed in Osaka and Tokyo. This is the ridiculously extended sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Foreign travel was not easily approved, and the reason the long scene was left in the movie was most likely to justify the trip the director and his crew took.
Wow.
That sounds ridiculous.
Yeah.
Way to, like,
you're gonna
stab your own project.
Yeah, why? It's like, no, we spent that much money and all that time, we better put 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's a hypothetical of, like, why it's in there, but it's interesting. It's somewhat interesting, I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It warrants mentioning.
Yes,
it's more what I felt.
Yeah, I feel like 30 seconds would have done it pretty
good. Yeah, two shots.
Yeah. Moving on.
Two shots max.
So on that note, we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. So it is in print still from Criterion as a 2-disc DVD or a 1-disc Blu-ray. It comes with the special features of an audio commentary by Andrei Tarkovsky's scholars Vida Johnson and Graham Petrie, 9 deleted and alternate scenes, video interview with actress Natalia Bondarchuk. Oh, God.
I love her.
Bondarchuk. Cinematographer Vadim Yusov, art director Mikhail Romadin.
You're doing well.
And composer Edward...
give it
here. Artemyev. I don't know.
Artemyev.
Yeah, I was close-ish.
Yeah, you're fine. You're trying to speak with confidence.
Yeah. Next.
That's just gotta go for it.
Okay. And composer Edward Alzheimer.
That's it.
Excerpt from a documentary about Stanislaw Lem, the author of the film's source novel, and usual booklet and essays that Criterion usually do. Most notably, this comes with an appreciation of the film written by director Akira Kurosawa, which is kind of interesting.
Nice. Did he like it a lot?
He did. He did. He got to visit the set even while they were making it.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
So did Roger Ebert. He gave it a 4 out of 4.
He loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess unless you guys have got anything else, that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode looking at Solaris.
I got nothing.
You got nothing?
Yeah, no.
All right. If you think we've missed anything or have any comments or queries, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com, or you can hit us up on Twitter @CriterionQuest or find us on Facebook by searching The Criterion Quest. But other than that, we will be back in a fortnight's time with an interesting film called Man Bites Dog.
Sounds fun.
Eric, do you want to hand Tom the DVD cover so we can have a look at the image?
Have you not seen it?
No.
Describe what you see, Tom.
Some ruffian shooting a baby in the face.
Man bites dog.
Yeah, there's no dog here.
It's a metaphor or something. Yeah. You'll find out in a fortnight.
It's a really, really interesting black comedy. It's an interesting one.
Cool.
But,
well, it looks fun.
Yeah. I guess other than that, the only other thing we could probably plug is another podcast series that Eric and I both have just recently started.
Yeah, it's great. It's called You Haven't Seen That?
Yeah, so it's a series where we're going to be systematically going through and filling in all the gaps of all the films Eric missed in the 80s and 90s growing up.
There were heaps. Heaps and heaps.
Yeah.
Heaps of good ones, too. And much easier to understand ones as well. So it's a nice light little break if you want a breather in between.
Yeah, I think our most recent episode was Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and we will have one coming out next week that I believe is Rocky.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So got a few on the way.
Yeah. So if that sounds interesting at all to you, please head over to iTunes or whatever podcast app you use and give it a listen. But for this week's episode of the Criterion Quest, I'm Chris.
I'm Eric.
I'm Tom. See you next time.